Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. Taking a break again from the Meghan and Harry stuff, and later this week, let's see, I still have an Epstein, actually I have a couple of parts of Epstein with some updates, some black book stuff, and Jonas Brothers Part 2, but today, as promised from last week, is the death of Jimi Hendrix. And once again, I'm joined by Jen. Jen, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
I'm lovely. You know, and I think that we both, like, we came to the agreement last week during the episode that we'd do Jimi Hendrix because he popped up when we were looking at Laurel Canyon kind of stuff, even though, you know, he obviously didn't die in Laurel Canyon or anything. And then he's also part of the 27 Club and so much more. And one of the things that I have to, look through my records, and I forgot to do it. Even as I'm talking to you now, I realized I forgot. But I think that I had one of Jimi Hendrix's relatives who had sent me some stuff before, and I need to go back and look through it. And so if we have to do a part two or an addendum to it or something like that, Jen and I will. But I just remember, it's been many, many years, maybe a decade ago, that they sent me something, which would make a lot of sense because I think that they were sending it to me about 2009 when a bunch of new information came out and stuff. But anyway, why don't you tell us a little bit about the death of Jimi Hendrix?
Okay, so September 18th of 1970, Jimi Hendrix, he joined that unhappy 27 Club, and we'll tell you what the 27 Club is, but he was found dead from an alleged drug overdose at the Samarkand Hotel in West London. And so we have to just ponder, did he die from a true overdose? You know, was it a suicide? Was it an accident? Or was he really waterboarded, like some people say?
Yeah, waterboarded with wine. You know, the problem is with this case and is this Monica Daneman, who could not keep a story straight to save her life. And she is the person who I think, well, unless you go with the murder aspect, she is the last person to have seen him alive. And therefore, it was her apartment / hotel room where he was found. And she made a career out of his death, essentially. And, you know, if you read the official accounts, you know, they say he's been in poor health and, you know, overworked and no sleep. And yeah, true. But he also, you know, because he was doing a ton of drugs, his shows were inconsistent. It was a lot like Amy Winehouse, another member of the 27 Club, who, when you watch Amy's performances from the last few months of her life or last year of her life, you never knew what you're going to get. You're either going to get somebody who performed really well, you're going to get somebody inconsistent, you're going to get somebody who couldn't remember any single word to any one of her songs and just hummed for a few minutes and then would walk up the stage.
Yeah, and Jimmy had shows like that. He would step out onto the stage and then he would just tell people, hey, you know, the band, we're not able to swing it. So that's it, folks. And they'd cut off the lights and tell everybody to go home.
And before, you know, the age of the internet or anything like that, these things did not spread around that quickly. And people were just like, well, I guess that's just the way it goes. And I will give up my money and don't get anything. Would you agree that the details of his final hours are nobody knows really what happened?
Yeah, no one knows because the only witness, that girlfriend, Daneman, you know, she kept changing her stories over and over again. And she doesn't just change, you know, tiny tidbits of information. It's crucial information.
Yeah. And there was a lot of pressure from a lot of groups, and her original story, the wiki version, is that she found Hendrix unresponsive in her apartment in Notting Hill and called for an ambulance at 11:18 in the morning. And then he was taken to the hospital where an attempt was made to resuscitate him, and he was pronounced dead at 12:45 p.m. I have no doubts that, you know, she called for an ambulance. Well, actually, nobody knows who called for the ambulance because England's version of 911 back then, I think 999, I mean, there's no recordings or anything, and I don't think that they ever interviewed the person who took the call to find out if it was a male or female's voice, did they?
I didn't read anything about a call taker being interviewed. But yeah, she called a lot of people before she called 999. You know, if she's the one who even called the ambulance, she did call, you know, some of his friends, and she was asking weird questions like, you know, who's Jimmy's doctor? You know, you think she would know something like that. But she also called over a roadie to help her clean up the room.
Yeah. The official postmortem examination said that Hendricks aspirated on his own vomit and died of asphyxia while intoxicated with barbiturates. And at the inquest, which they do in England, the coroner found no evidence of suicide and, lacking sufficient evidence of the circumstances, just recorded an open verdict. So they left it open. That's exactly what it means. We don't know if it's a suicide. We don't know if it's an accident. We don't know if there was foul play involved. Now, Monica said that Jimmy had taken 9 of her prescribed Vesperix sleeping tablets. Apparently, he took 9, and you're only supposed to take a half of one of them, so essentially 18 times the recommended dosage. Jimmy, though, normally took 2 because he was so, you know, immune to the effects of barbiturates.
Yeah, and he had quite the tolerance, but the thing is that, you know, with the alcohol with it, you know, it really just, it makes it even that much stronger when you mix something like that with alcohol. And they said the alcohol was in his lungs, it was in his throat, there was so much of it, even in his stomach, but it hadn't reached his bloodstream yet.
Yes, which is interesting, because I think he had the equivalent of 4 pints of beer. I mean, that's essentially. Now, he did have a very low tolerance for alcohol because he did so many drugs. He didn't really do alcohol and hadn't built up any kind of tolerance. So he would act really, really crazy when he was drinking. Now, Monica was a German figure skater and a painter. She was at one point the wife of Uli Roth of the Scorpions, the guitarist. But she essentially made her living off of painting paintings of Jimi Hendrix and being the person who was, you know, there when he died.
Place is creepy. Did you see pictures of that? I mean, it's just a total shrine to Jimi Hendrix.
And she, up until the time of her death, when reporters would talk to her, they say that she essentially stopped living that day, and just her hair and everything was exactly the same as it had been in 1970. So I thought that was kind of weird. Now, one of the things that a lot of people bring up is Monica said that she and Jimmy had been together for about 18 months and that they were engaged.
Yeah, but she didn't have any proof of that. And also she said that he wrote her letters constantly and she wouldn't produce the notes either.
So my guess is that they, exactly what you just said, there's no photos of them anywhere together, unlike, you know, his longtime girlfriend, Kathy Etchingham, who there's pictures on the internet. And, you know, granted, it was, you know, the 60s and a lot of them are not still there or anything. It's not the worst cell phone and everybody's taking photos all the time. Her story is that she first met Jimmy back in the very first part of 1969. In Dusseldorf after being invited to a concert there. And she spent that night with him and then went to his next concert. And then they didn't see each other, I guess, until April 1969. You know, so 18 months together, but if you're only seeing him 2 days, 3 days, is that really 18 months together?
No, not technically.
No. But I think what some reporters and authors have deduced is that she never talks about any night, really, other than the night that he died. So did they have other stories together? You know,
probably not. I mean, for someone that has their entire place, you know, shrined out to someone, you know, you think that she'd hang up photos and letters and stuff like that. You know, if she doesn't have them and she can't produce them, I start to think that her story is a little shaky. You know, maybe she was a lot more into him than, you know, he was into her, because he loved the ladies. You know, he kept a whole bunch of ladies around him.
He loved the ladies. And After the September 1970 European tour, he started a relationship with this Danish model, Kirsten Neffer. And the Danish press said that they were engaged. But Neffer had to leave London to go to work. And so Jimmy being Jimmy, he starts hooking up with Monica on the 15th of September. That is probably, I'm guessing, I don't think it's the first time that they hooked up, but I don't think that they were together for 18 months. I think that they hooked up probably, this is my guess, that she says that she saw Hendrix once when she traveled to London on April 25th, 1969, in the hope of meeting him again, where she bumped into him at the Speakeasy Club, and she said that they spent some time together over the next 9 days, but she only spent one night with him. My guess is that she spent one night with him and got a phone number or got something, and then when Kirsten left, he just called Monica and said, hey, you know, let's hook up. And starting on the 15th of September, I think that that's what happened. That's my guess.
I do too. No, I think that you're onto something, because Eric Clapton had said in one of his interviews that, you know, she was someone that he didn't realize had been around very long. So that kind of tells me, since he was close to Jimmy, that she probably wasn't around very long. And she was also a person that would arrange threesomes for Jimmy. She was bisexual.
So on the evening of September 17th, he took... This is, again, where, you know, things get confusing and tracing exactly what he did. One of the problems with Monica is that in 1996, she either committed suicide or was murdered, depending on how far deep you want to go down the rabbit hole of conspiracy. Her husband or ex-husband, he said that he thought her death was a result of foul play. And, you know, we can go into more detail about that, but apparently did she believe in reincarnation or something like that? And she thought suicide was a sin and would never do it.
Yeah, pretty much.
Because in 1996, she was found guilty of contempt of court for breaching an order of the court to not repeat false allegations she had previously made against Kathy Etchingham. Because you essentially have two people who are, well, Monica is the crazed fan who does the shrine, and Kathy was somebody who had her life together and was trying to later on in life figure out exactly what happened to Jimmy, and had the assistance of the wife of one of the band members of the Animals, who were managed by the same person that managed Jimmy. And they came up with a 30-page report, which is phenomenal. And I mean, they really spent some time going over everything.
They did. Kathy did such a good job. She was able to convince the attorney general to look into this, you know, to do a further investigation into his death.
Yeah. And so anyway, 2 days after this guilty contempt of court, she was found dead in her Mercedes-Benz in Sussex, of all places. Hello, Sussex. And I don't know. You know, she was fined like £1,000, so $1,500. She wasn't going to go to jail or anything. This was not, you know, a horrible, horrible crime or anything. There was no, you know, there was nothing to it. So her reasons for committing suicide seem, I don't know.
I mean, if she committed suicide because she could no longer talk about him, she did have an interview lined up with some type of radio person. So she fully anticipated, you know, talking about Jimmy more. But after she was found, you know, guilty in court, she couldn't do that anymore. So, I mean, is that a reason why she would go and, I don't know, fumigate herself in the car?
I don't know. And maybe it was an accident or something, and, you know, she left the car on, or I don't know. I don't think that she was murdered. So, I mean, I'm going to have to go with suicide. I just, you know, this Uli guy talked to her all the time, and he said the only reason that he even moved out was he needed more space for his studio, and, you know, that they knew that they weren't really right for each other, but they knew each other really well, and she had painted Scorpion's album covers and things like that. So, you know, if he says that she's just not the person to commit suicide, you kind of have to go with that, but I just, why would she be murdered? Because she doesn't really, you know anything.
Well, in that interview that she had set up, you know, that was upcoming, she did say that she was going to do kind of like a tell-all. But when it comes to her, you know, what would her tell-all be? She'd already told so many different versions of stories. You know, would people even believe her? You know, would someone want to kill her because they thought she was what, credible?
Yeah.
I mean.
So she was fined, yes. She had lost a libel action against Etchingham, and it was, she was ordered to pay £1,000 in damages and costs because of what she said. She said, Miss Etchingham, quote, would cheat and lie for money and stole the guitarist's belongings from his apartment while he was away on tour. And then she said it again in 1995 when she published her book, The Inner World of Jimi Hendrix, to coincide with the anniversary of his death. And, you know, but it doesn't seem like she didn't leave a note. And the neighbor said, I'm really shocked by the news. I saw her yesterday. She was doing the gardening. So, you know, and Roth said the thing looks suspicious. She had a lot of death threats against her over the years, and she was just about the most pure and innocent person I've ever met. But I feel that the press and media completely crucified her, and she wasn't in a position to defend herself. It's absolutely tragic because she was a totally genuine person. I always felt that she was really being crucified in front of everybody, and there was nothing anyone could do about it. He said she didn't believe in the concept of suicide. She believed in life after death, and she considered suicide a sin.
Makes it tough to try to gauge whether she did it or not. Because, you know, you never know what goes through someone's head when they decide to make a move like that.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go over Monica's chain of events. And her chain of events is crazy. Okay. She said, and remember, she's changed her story. So this is just one account of her chain of events. There are multiple times when she couldn't remember one thing that she'd said before, and so she put something else in there. So this is one account. And she says that Jimmy went to see Devin Wilson, who was somebody that he would sleep with frequently. And Monica says that she drove Jimmy to Devin's, but he only stayed a few minutes. And the reason that he went to Devin's is because apparently he was engaged to Devin, too, along with the Danish model. Everybody thought they were engaged to Jimmy. And so she drove him there, and he only stayed a few minutes. And then they got back to Danneman's hotel room, apartment, whatever, at 8:30 p.m. She says that she made him eat a meal, and they drank white wine, even though, okay. And then he had a bath and washed his hair. Then they spent a couple of hours talking and listening to music. And then at 1:30 a.m., Jimmy rang Chaz Chandler's office. And Chaz Chandler was somebody who had been his creative manager. He and Michael Jeffrey were kind of co-managers, although Chaz kind of got bought out of his, but that's what it was. And apparently left a message of, I need help, bad man. But Monica never mentions this, and others have tried to say it kind of, it happened on a different night. Then Jimmy's still not asleep. At 1:45 in the morning, Monica says that Jimmy said, hey, I want to go see some people. And she says that they were not his friends. Again, I don't know how she would know this because she's really only known him for a couple of days. And so she says that she dropped him off of there and picked him up an hour later, about 3 o'clock in the morning. And when he came home, she made him a tuna fish sandwich.
That's one version.
I know. And then she says, that 6 a.m. that something's kind of wrong, and that Jimmy said that Devin had slipped him an OD. And then Monica says that Jimmy took a handful of sleeping pills, these 9. And then he then apparently urged her, Monica, not to commit suicide, which is weird. And then he kept talking to her until she was asleep. And then, but in another account, she doesn't mention this, and she said that she took a sleeping pill and fell asleep at 7. And then Monica says this. She says that after 10 o'clock, so Chaz calls back, and Jimmy at 10 o'clock in the morning, this is what Monica said, said that Jimmy answered the phone and said, call me a bit later. You know, and then at 10:20, Monica wakes up and finds Jimmy asleep and goes out for cigarettes. So, you know, this is where
all kind of problems with that story. Yeah, so if he thought he was slipped an OD, why would he turn around and take sleeping pills on top of it?
Exactly. Right. And a handful of them, 9. And so she goes out for cigarettes. She comes back and she finds Jimmy still asleep, but he's been sick. So then instead of calling 999 or whatever, she calls Eric Burdon, who's the lead singer of the Animals, and says, hey, what should I do? And he hung up on her and then said, hey, call an ambulance. Okay, so that was 10:20, according to her. The ambulance was called what time? 11:17 or something like that?
Yeah, her reasoning was is that she didn't want him to get cross with her for calling an ambulance. You know, if he came too suddenly, he might be angry to see ambulance people surrounding him. So that was her excuse.
And then she says that the ambulance guys came and that he was still alive then. That's what she says. And then they ruled him dead. Now, the reality is that he had been dead for about 6 or 7 hours, maybe.
Yeah, easily.
Before the ambulance got there. Okay, so there was no 10 o'clock in the morning thing. There was no, it was 6 or 7 hours. And this guy, this coroner or something like that, discovered that there was rice in Hendrick's stomach, and apparently he knew how long it took to digest and all this kind of stuff. And that Jimmy had eaten at a dinner party. And Monica never mentioned that. And she says that he didn't go out until 1:45 in the morning. But really, he had been out at 11 p.m. to eat dinner, because everybody eats dinner at 11 p.m. So her story is just all messed up. And I'm wondering if she was worried. I mean, there's something I found when, you know, she's German. She's in a different country. Apparently, her father was very conservative. And, you know, here she is in Jimi Hendrix's bed and with drugs everywhere. And she just didn't know what to do and told the police one story and just later on just changed it to fit whatever kind of narrative she wanted to do.
That, or she knew, you know, if he was murdered, who did it, and that, you know, she could be next if she said something. So she had to tell this whole chain of events that was incorrect because she couldn't tell the truth. You know, it's her flat, so someone had to have come in. If he was waterboarded with wine, someone had to have come in there. She would have seen them. She lied about basically the whole evening leading up to that. You know, they weren't just sitting at home listening to records and drinking white wine. You know, they had went out to a party, perhaps maybe even two parties that night, because multiple people saw him. He was smoking weed. He was possibly tripping on LSD. That was one of his favorite things to do. So why did she hold that kind of stuff back? Unless she thinks that it connects to something else that's the literal truth here, you know, of what happened to him. Because this guy did not die on some sleeping pills.
No. And we'll talk about that party in a little bit, because it has a person involved, and then Bob Levine, who we'll talk about briefly, because he gave a totally different account in 2011 to some things. And it also, he mentions in an interview at that time, though, about Michael Jeffrey and stuff like that, which can take you down the murder road. But the ambulance men who came, they said that they came to the apartment and there was nobody there except for Jimmy on the bed, already dead.
And with fully dressed.
Fully dressed.
And you would think if someone was going to get into bed and pull back the sheets, they would take off their clothes, right?
Yep. And he also had a scarf around his neck, and they said they tried to revive him, but they knew he was dead when they walked in. I mean, there was no, you know, just it was standard procedure. And then they drove him to the hospital. You know, she had said that she rode in the hospital in the ambulance with him.
Oh, yeah. She went on to blame the ambulance driver, saying that they set him up incorrectly, and that's what made him choke on his own vomit and die. But that never happened because she wasn't in the ambulance.
Plus, he was already dead.
Yeah, so, he was, you know, well dead. Yeah, he'd been dead for hours. When they got him to the hospital, they did not check him in. They took him straight to the morgue.
So, you know, we're going to talk about Michael Jeffrey in a little bit. And, you know, what kind of connection he has to this. You know, one of, and I forget the website, and I'm going to have to apologize to her on a different episode, but she wrote a couple of articles about it and speculated some things. And one of the things that she speculated was that Monica kept feeding Jimmy. That was in her story, you know, the tuna fish sandwich. I made him some dinner. I made him eat a meal. You know, I didn't just cook for him. I made him eat. And was she lacing his food with the barbiturates found in his blood?
Possibly.
You know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, that time they, you know, they were filled with powder and it would have been pretty easy to do. And, you know, he's always pretty messed up. So is he really going to even notice?
Probably where did not. He trusted, you know, her.
Where did she go before the ambulance arrived? Why did she claim that she was still there? And here's the thing that's the really important point that this person says. The media swallowed her version of events so readily for so many years. It wasn't until Kathleen came along with her friend and gave the detailed report that people said, okay, Monica's story is just messed up. But because of the fact that she was the one, the last one to see him alive, unless he was murdered, everybody, you know, just says, oh yeah, this is Monica's version of events. And, you know, she had a lot of fame for being the person that was there when Jimmy died.
Yeah, and the strange thing about the whole situation is that I think a lot of people kind of pushed her story, you know, because they liked that narrative. His autopsy report is literally one page. I mean, I'm used to getting like 8 pages, you know, 9 pages, especially on a celebrity, and there's just nothing to it. So it tells me that they didn't, you know, they didn't go in depth on this.
Yeah. Let's talk about, I keep mentioning Kathleen. Kathleen met Jimmy when she was 20 in London back in 1966, and they became a couple before he was famous. And according to Kathleen, she was the inspiration for The Wind Cries Mary, which she says was penned after an argument, Foxy Lady, and that during one of the first performances of this number, Jimmy points her out from the stage. And then as the Katharina in 1983, and also, funny enough, as the subject of Send My Love to Linda. The original lyrics were Send My Love to Kathy, but she didn't want to actually be named. And then in 1969, she and Jimmy kind of drifted apart a little bit. But this is somebody that everybody knew was with Jimmy and the official kind of girlfriend. And, you know, this is 3 years, essentially. So let's talk about Michael Jeffrey for a second. He is Hendrix's manager. And he was also the Animals' manager. And the Animals hated him. When they always suspected that he was stealing from them, and they were proven correct after years and years of performing. I think that they said that they had like $1,000 in their bank account or something like that. And he was not really a nice guy. He was just always looking out for whatever kind of money he could find for himself and exploiting everything and just stealing and stealing. And when he would get into trouble, he would borrow money, and he had a habit of borrowing money from the mob.
So. Yeah, he was definitely loan sharking. I mean, this guy had offshore bank accounts in the Bahamas. He could steal from any client that he had and just funnel that money through the chemical bank.
Yep. And he was also involved with Don Arden. And Don Arden was kind of the mob boss of music. And he, Don Arden, has a very, very famous daughter. And that daughter is Sharon Osbourne. So, you know, Sharon Osbourne learned at the feet of the mob boss of music. And anyway, so you have Michael Jeffrey, and this is part of the whole conspiracy thing, is that he completed his education. And he took a job as a clerk, and then he got drafted into the military. And the military loved how educated he was. And so even though he, you know, signed on to be a soldier, he ended up in the intelligence corps. And then because he's in the intelligence corps, people don't know exactly what he did. It just kind of all went into that, you know, into the Ethernet kind of thing. Nobody knows exactly what he did, but he was rumored to have still been in the intelligence services all throughout this, and that he had connections to the CIA. And in his obituary, his dad said that Michael could speak Russian. And the CIA kept a report, kept a file on Jimi Hendrix, because Jimi Hendrix would perform for some organizations that were not in lockstep with the United States government. So you also have this kind of thing circling everywhere.
Yeah, that's where the political assassination theories come in.
Yeah, and you know, and a lot of that kind of stuff makes sense.
Well, back then, I mean, groups needed money in order for them to prosper. So if they had a group, especially a hate group, come in and they were trying to, you know, get a movement going, they have someone like Jimi Hendrix that's pulling in a lot of money and he has a large reach, you know, as far as the type of audience that he can get to. You know, they can't have somebody like Jimi Hendrix funding someone like that. That's dangerous.
Yeah. So Jeffrey managed the animals, and the way that Jeffrey managed to sign Jimi Hendrix was because this Chas Chandler guy, who ends up being the co-manager, had seen Jimi Hendrix and wanted to manage Jimi Hendrix himself, but ended up kind of co-managing him with Jeffrey. And one of the things that happened when you, well, it even happens now, I always talk about it, the way you make money in music is by touring. Because record contracts are so one-sided, especially on a first record or something like that. And plus, even if you get paid, you're getting paid way, way, way down the road, your royalties. You could be waiting 6 months or a year or something like that. So what do? You tour. And Jeffrey, Michael Jeffrey, would have Jimmy and all of his bands touring constantly. You know, all year, he would have them tour every single night of the year, all year long, every single year, if he could. And, you know, he needed them to tour so that way the money would be kind of keep coming in.
Oh, yeah. They had trash bags full of money every night, just thousands of dollars. And that's the kind of lifestyle that Jeffrey was used to.
One of the things in the deal that Michael Jeffrey signed with Warner Brothers was that essentially he got all of the rights. First of all, he got all the masters, and he got all of the rights to any soundtracks to movies. So what Michael did was he produced a couple of movies, including this one called Rainbow Bridge, and another one which I can't think of right off the top of my head, but I will in a minute. Oh, I think it was Jimi Hendrix at Berkeley, which were really, really popular. And they made a ton of money, and Warner's really didn't get any piece of it because they had put this exclusion on soundtracks. So, you know, Michael Jeffrey was just making a ton of money. And after Jimmy died, what Michael Jeffrey did was he went on tour with some bands and also the movie Rainbow Bridge. And I guess it was a huge success, and he you know, kept rolling in the cash. Michael Jeffrey is a interesting character. And one of the things I'm trying to, if I want to talk about the Jeffrey confession to the roadie or, okay, let's talk about that. So there was a book, right, that was written, by that roadie, that you mentioned. His name's James Tappy Wright, I think.
Yeah, that's him.
And he says, and the whole book is essentially, based on, well, I mean, actually, there's a ton of interesting stories in the book, a lot of them. But it says essentially that he claims that Michael Jeffrey drunkenly confessed to killing Hendrix. And the quote was, "I was in London the night of Jimmy's death, and together with some old friends, we went round to Monica's hotel room, got a handful of pills and stuffed them into his mouth, then poured a few bottles of red wine deep into his windpipe. I had to do it. Jimmy is worth much more to me dead than alive. That son of a bitch was going to leave me. If I lost him, I'd lose everything." All of that is, a lot of that's an accurate statement. Jimmy was going to leave him. Jimmy was worth much more dead than alive. And the bottles of red wine, which we can talk about in a little bit, as you said, they didn't ever get to his stomach. A lot of them didn't get to his stomach.
And yeah, they didn't get, yeah, no reaching his bloodstream, which is really telling.
Yeah. which means that, well, you can probably explain it better than I can. Does that mean that he was already dead? Or that they were just so much in there that, or he died before it could get to his bloodstream?
He died before it could get to his bloodstream. That's how much they had poured.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
He drowned before his body could even process what was happening.
Let me talk about something really quickly. Okay. So this Bob Levine guy that I mentioned, he was the U.S. manager for Jimi Hendrix. So you had Mike Jeffrey was the U.K. manager, but Bob Levine was the U.S. manager. And he was interviewed by a writer named John McDermott. And he said that it took a week after Jimmy's death for Mike to call the New York office, pretending that he had only just found out. Okay. Mike Jeffrey had a meal ticket. That meal ticket was Jimi Hendrix. He checked in with that meal ticket every single day.
You know he did.
I know. And pretending that he had only just found out. A week. So the entire world knows that Jimi Hendrix is dead, but he calls and just, oh, I just found out today. But Bob,
you're talking about a guy who kept Jimmy under his thumb. I mean, he wouldn't even let the guy sleep. Like you said, he kept him so exhausted from touring and just go, go, go constantly because it was a means of controlling him.
And Bob says, but I knew he was lying because I had spoken to people who saw him at a party. Track Records had staged in London the night before Hendrix died. And who were these people? Now, remember, this is something that Monica never talked about. This is one of those parties. And who were these people? According to Bob Levine, the very same people that had been at the apartment of Peter Cameron, the man with links to Track Records, where Jimmy had been seen that same evening. That was when Devin Wilson was there, and Alan and Stella Douglas. Now, Alan Douglas was somebody that was rumored to going to be the new manager of Jimi Hendrix. And was this the same party? Oh, and so then Mike Jeffrey goes to this party, but apparently didn't see Jimmy. So he arrived and left early, and Jimmy turned up later.
You know, that would be just the one time that guy said he didn't see Jimmy.
I know.
That's right? Really weird. Yeah.
I know. And so that was just kind of, to me, when we get back to saying, you know, something happened or if he was murdered and this confession to James Taffy Wright, you know, you kind of got to think. And Bob Levine is a straight up guy. And like I said, later on in 2011, he said in a different interview, despite the allegations that have recently been made, and that's talking about James Taffy Wright's book, I need to set the record straight once and for all. Jimmy died an accidental death, but he definitely wasn't murdered. Not by Michael Jeffrey, his UK manager, and certainly not by anybody connected to him. The whole thing is one giant lie. Okay. But he doesn't know that. He wasn't there. He was in the U.S. You know?
Yeah, he's kind of on the quick draw to say what did or did not happen. And this Taffy Wright roadie guy, somewhere in that book, he goes on about how he told Bob Levine that he knew what had happened, and he told him what Michael Jeffrey said, and he told the guy, you know, maybe you should just be quiet and disappear for a while.
And according to Alan Douglas, this Alan Douglas guy, like I said, who was rumored to maybe be the next manager of Jimmy, Alan Douglas, who is also a straight-up guy, claims that Michael Jeffrey told him the same thing, that he also confessed killing Jimmy to Alan Douglas. There, you would think, okay, well, there's no statute of limitations on murder. Maybe we could, you know, talk about this. Now, here's something that's really interesting. Barely a month after James Taffy Wright was told, that Mike Jeffrey had killed Jimi Hendrix, Mike Jeffrey was dead. Maybe.
yeah, you said maybe.
Maybe. Here's the thing. There was definitely an Iberian Airways flight that there was a mid-air collision over France, and he was flying back from Mallorca, which he went to a lot. And there was no survivors. Obviously, it's a mid-air collision. However, Mike was terrified of flying and was in the habit of making several reservations at once and then choosing his flight at the last minute to escape the fates. And, you know, you didn't have to, so you'd have all these and you could get refunds. There was, you know, not really a non-refundable ticket thing back then. And, you know, so he disappeared. Now, did he actually die in a plane crash? Or did he conveniently say, you know, I was drunk and I confessed to murdering Jimi Hendrix. Maybe I should disappear. And, you know,
who knows, you know, what type of flight manifest records did they keep back then?
Exactly.
You know, they probably weren't as strict as they are now.
Exactly. Plus, he chose his flight at the last minute. So he's buying tickets. He's making reservations and buying tickets. And so all these airlines would have a record that, you know, he bought a ticket. Now, did they keep, like you said, good enough records where, okay, this person didn't actually get on the flight. They had a ticket, but they didn't get on the flight. Then we're talking, you know, 1973, leaving from Mallorca. So
exactly. So even if a Michael Jeffrey boarded that flight, was it the Michael Jeffrey? That's another thing, is that this guy is an intelligence. You know, I don't put anything past him.
Exactly. And, you know, it's a lot easier to disappear in 1973 than it is now.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they used to have people getting on planes that didn't belong, you know, sneaking on, people exchanging passes. All of that stuff happened.
I think that, I forgot what I was going to say now, but with Michael Jeffrey and that CIA stuff, you know, it just kind of, and it was a month after, right? It was a month after he supposedly confessed to the roadie. And, oh, I know what I was going to say. And he set up that offshore corporation. And back then, you know, with the stuff offshore and everything, it was a lot easier to get things out of, and it was harder for governments to trace it and find out where, you know, being wired all over the place. Governments really didn't have the ability to do that. So he probably would have had access to this account. And I've never seen anybody talk about what happened to the money in that account.
Yeah, a lot of things about the background in his life they're still sketchy. I'd like to know if anyone checked on the finances as well, but he could have definitely just withdrew that and disappeared because, you know, they didn't keep up with people.
So one thing I want to mention, and then I think we're going to have a second part, is that James Tappy Wright, he says that he admits he saw no, you know, corroborative evidence at all then or since for Mike's story. But you know, later we can talk about what Kathleen did, Kathleen? I can't remember now. But he said whoever was involved was still out there and they might have thought Mike told me everything. So I kept my mouth shut. Although I did tell my close friend, Bob Levine, who was part of Jimmy's management team in New York. He told me to disappear. Okay. So that paragraph. He said, I did tell Bob Levine. And then Bob Levine in 2011 says, oh, no, nothing like this happened.
Oh, yeah, and Bob Levine's distancing. He's like, don't drag me into this.
But he doesn't mention, he says that Jimmy wasn't murdered. But he didn't say, hey, you know, I didn't, you know, he doesn't say whether or not James Tappy Wright told him or not, you know. And he doesn't say whether or not he told him to disappear.
Yeah, he leaves all of that alone.
Yeah. So anyway, I think that there's plenty for a second part, and also it'll give me time to look into, I know somebody wrote me something, it was one of the relatives. So I'm gonna look at that and find that, and Jen and I will do part two of the Jimi Hendrix death next week. Thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And now we don't have a ton of research to do for next week, so bonus!
Yeah. I love that. Except for you, I have to go find that little treasure.
I do.
Whatever
have to go
they
find
sent
that
you.
Treasure. I do. Anyway, have a good week, and I will talk to you next week.
All right. Bye.
Bye.